I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A federal judge in Philadelphia signs off on a settlement between Amtrak and the victims and family of a deadly train derailment last year. WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports that it's the costliest settlement Amtrak has ever paid.
$265 million will be doled out to survivors of the crash and family members of those who died in the derailment at Frankfort Junction. A federal judge will decide how much each victim receives by June. Attorney Thomas Klein says victims will have the chance to go before a court-appointed third party to describe their injuries.
We have established a full compensation program where every claim will be determined on its true and full merits.
The crash occurred in May of last year when a train going more than double the speed limit careened off a curve in North Philadelphia. More than 200 people were injured. 8 people died. Music director David Hayes was one of the passengers who survived. Here he is describing the crash that day.
It seemed like it started banking, which is not unusual going around the curve, but then the banking got more severe, and suddenly we realized that something was very, very wrong, and our car sort of flipped over on its side and was kind of grinding into the side of the embankment.
Federal law caps the amount Amtrak can pay in damages at $295 million, $30 million more than the settlement. Attorney Robert Mongaluzzi, who is representing some of the victims, says the focus should not be on reaching the full amount possible if it means years in the courtroom.
For these victims of this derailment, it is more important to get money now when they are struggling to pay their mortgages, to send their kids to college, and facing the daily struggles that you face when you've been injured or a family member has been killed in a catastrophe such as this.
Amtrak says in a statement that it, quote, appreciates the guidance and involvement of the court, but the Railroad Service declined to comment further since the case is ongoing. For WHYY, I'm Joe Hernandez.
In 1970, one of three Philadelphians worked in manufacturing. Now, it's one in 10. That's a big reason why more than a quarter of Philadelphia residents live in poverty. In the 2016 presidential election, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have made big promises to bring those good-paying manufacturing jobs back. WHYY's Katie Culinary looks at what that could mean for the poorest big city in America.
Whatever you guys do and girls, do not look at any of the blue light.
Inside the PTR Baylor factory in Philadelphia, plant manager Bob Walker is giving a tour to a group of middle schoolers. He walks them past a robot that's welding steel to make recycling and trash compactors for big box stores like Target and Walmart. Bright yellow sparks fly into the air as the robot arm works the metal.
This used to take us about 90 minutes to weld by hand. Now we're welding it in 27.
Walker's worked here for almost 30 years, since he was fresh out of high school. In that time, he says the company has grown from 40 employees to more than 140. And that hasn't happened in spite of automation like the robot. Walker says it's happened because of it.
For example, a Walmart machine used to take us 50 hours to build it. We automated it. We gave the guys some jib cranes, some tooling, and we were able to get that machine down to 38 hours. With that combination, we were able to discount the baler so we can actually get the work. Once we got the work, it was such a large amount of work, we had to hire people. I mean, I just got out of a meeting last night. They want me to hire 10 more men because of all the work.
While manufacturing production is on the rise in Philadelphia and across the country, the number of workers needed to make things has dropped significantly. The city says more than three-quarters of manufacturers in Philadelphia have fewer than 20 employees. That's what makes PTR Baylor so unusual.
I think we're a dinosaur here. We're heavy manufacturing, and there's not a lot of these companies left in the city.
Walker won't say who he's supporting for president, but he likes the idea of the government pressuring manufacturers that have moved their operations overseas. That's something both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have proposed to create new jobs.
My economic agenda can be summed up in three such beautiful words: jobs, jobs, jobs.
We are going to have the biggest job creation program that we've had in our country since World War II.
Clinton has promised new investments in manufacturing, infrastructure, and clean energy, while Trump is vowing to lure companies back to American soil with tax cuts and scaled-back government regulations. But if these companies did come back to Philadelphia, would they bring the kind of jobs the more than 400,000 residents living in poverty could fill? Tim Steyer would know. He's a job counselor at the Philadelphia Unemployment Project and helps about 400 people a year look for work. Many of them don't have college degrees, and they're frustrated.
I call them the leftovers. People say, I worked all my life. I worked in a factory, but I'm 55 years old, and all I have is a high school diploma, and nobody wants to hire me.
Steyer says the problem is not that there aren't enough jobs available or that people don't have the aptitude. The problem is they don't have the training they need, especially as jobs require higher technical skills. But Steyer is optimistic. He tells me about a guy named Leonard, who's currently enrolled in a math refresher course so he can get a job in the energy industry in Marcus Hook.
So we're saying, okay, maybe he doesn't have all the skill sets, but we'll train him and get him ready for the job.
When it comes to the presidential race, Steyer thinks Clinton has been clearer about what today's jobs demand and the kind of training workers need to fill them, while Trump is clinging to a past that won't return.
Before, well, it was more neck down work, using your body and lifting and all. It's not like that no more. A lot of it's more neck up stuff, where you got another candidate says, yeah, we're going to put picks and hammers in your hand again. Who makes them? Who makes the picks and the hammers?
Steyer says that's something his clients also have to come to terms with.
Good to see you, mommy.
Avery Siplin recently stopped by the jobs club Steyer hosts every Tuesday. It's like a group therapy session for people struggling to find work. For more than 20 years, he was a welder for the Bud Company, which made roofs, doors, and fenders for Ford, Chrysler, and other automakers in North Philadelphia. He made good money there.
You could come right off the street, like, didn't know nothing. It started off with $14 an hour. Then like, after a couple of years, you know, you up to $16, $17 an hour.
But in 2002, the Bud Company closed down its Philadelphia factory, leaving 600 workers out of a job, including Siplin. While searching for work, the 67-year-old says he has a lot of time to watch the presidential campaign on TV. When he hears Clinton and Trump talk about jobs, he's skeptical.
Yeah, they don't talk non-specific how they're going to get these jobs, you know, because all the jobs. And that's another thing.
After the Bud Company closed down in Philadelphia, it consolidated operations in Detroit. Then it opened a new plant in Mexico. Siplin thinks if companies can continue to get cheaper labor in other countries, there's nothing a president can do to change that, even a President Trump.
Yeah, I don't see how you're going to do that, how you're going to threaten them.
Siplin has accepted that he won't find a job like his old one. Those days are over, he says. Katie Colinari, WHYY News.
4 years after Superstorm Sandy made landfall along the Jersey coastline, thousands of Garden State residents still have yet to finish rebuilding, and some of them told their stories to an assembly committee this afternoon. On hand there and joining me is Susan Martichek, Executive Director of the Ocean County Long-Term Recovery Group. Sue, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
What was the gist of today's hearing?
The main part is to make sure that people know that Sandy is far from over and that there are literally thousands of people who are still trying to get back home.
Be more specific. To what extent are they still in the rebuilding process?
Well, today's talk really hammered home on some of the challenges to the recovery. And although we do know that Superstorm Sandy was a very large natural disaster, the truth of the matter is, the recovery is a man-made disaster. It is really the programs and services that are being put in place that are not being run effectively and unfortunately is costing a lot of people to return home.
For example, apparently many applied for grants and then got to the point where they just gave up on hopes of receiving them.
We had people as recently as last week dropping out of the program after receiving the $150,000, but knowing that they could not figure out how to complete the project. So they would actually cause themselves more harm if they started the project and could not finish it, so they returned the grant money.
Would you say overall that the recovery has been satisfactory to most residents and businesses?
Well, I don't know if I can give you a clear answer on that, because you have to understand the reason people reach out to us is usually because they are in trouble. not many people call our line to tell us that they're home and they didn't have any problems. We get about 10 to 20 calls a week from new people saying that they are stuck in the recovery and they need our assistance.
And when they call, what forms of assistance can your group offer?
Sometimes being an advocate for them and providing knowledge and guidance so they can get home with the resources that they have on hand. Many times it's to try to find additional resources out in the community because there is a gap in their construction budget. And unfortunately, we're starting to see that we're helping out people who are not getting back home. Their recovery plan, unfortunately, is not going to work out. So we work with those people also to try to figure out some way that they can navigate the new chapter of their life, even if it is not returning home.
Can you put the specific recovery and restoration efforts post Sandy in the broader context of the appropriate way to deal with what seems to be permanent climate change? Now, there are efforts towards beach replenishment, but many, including Jeff Tittle of the Sierra Club of New Jersey, says that's really money and effort poorly spent, that what's needed instead is dune management.
Well, it was brought up today in the testimonies from people that in New Jersey, we really do not have a climate or a coastal plan. And I think anyone who's been through Sandy is recognizing that we are desperately in need of beginning a conversation in this state on how to deal with climate change and rising sea levels, and that it needs to be done, you know, with across the board, different academics, environmental people, business people. It's a conversation. I mean, New Jersey is a peninsula. We have a lot of water touching us. We really do need to figure out how we're going to spend the next decades dealing with this.
Sue, thanks for taking time to join us following this afternoon's hearings.
Oh, you're most welcome, Dave.
Susan Martichek, Executive Director of the Ocean County Long-Term Recovery Group. Nearly a decade has passed since Pennsylvania's Marcellus Shale natural gas boom took off. But the state has only finalized new regulations for drillers within the past month. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports that the process of creating them led to a bitter fight between environmentalists, the industry, and state regulators, and it's not over yet.
Scott Perry, who heads the Oil and Gas Office at the State Department of Environmental Protection, recently spoke to a room full of gas industry representatives at a conference in Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
He began by telling a story about a time he'd gotten into a fist fight with a friend in the 11th grade.
It was pretty lame, actually, because neither one of us actually wanted to fight the other one. And during the course of kind of like the wrestling around, I was like, you used to be my friend. Why are you doing this? And he's like, well, those guys said you said all these things about me and that you were going to kick my, you know.
And they'd only started fighting because two senior guys were egging them on.
I kind of feel like I'm in a bit of that same situation now, where I'm meeting with folks and on the side they're saying, Scott, you know, I really think that there's going to be some litigation involving these rules.
He spent the next hour or so politely asking the industry to please not sue the agency over the new regulations.
There's a better way of doing business than just fighting about it all the time.
Among other things, the new rules create tougher standards for waste management and replacing damaged water supplies. Another section gives DEP more oversight of well permit applications near public resources, such as parks. It's a provision Perry knew was a major sticking point for the industry.
Don't let the first call be to your lawyer.
That appeal was not successful. Within a week of them taking effect earlier this month, the trade group, the Marcellus Shale Coalition, filed a lawsuit, while another industry group already had one in the works. Here's Coalition President David Spiegelmeyer discussing the rules, known as Chapter 78A.
There are aspects of Chapter 78A that are onerous, costly, and they provide little environmental benefit from our perspective.
The regulations had been in the works for nearly 6 years, and discussions around them had prompted a knockdown, drag-out fight. For example, last year, DEP angered many in the industry when it changed the makeup of some drilling advisory panels. At a public meeting, an industry lobbyist invoked Al Pacino's performance in the movie Justice for All. You know the line.
You're out of order! The whole trial is out of order! They're out of order!
Yeah, he told the room the whole proceeding was out of order. And from there, things didn't get much better.
It was the closest thing to a public execution that I've ever attended.
State Senator Gene Yaw is the Republican chair of the Senate Environmental Resources and Energy Committee. He opposes the rules and was describing a February meeting at DEP where they were adopted. And here's what a House committee meeting sounded like last spring as the Democratic and Republican chairs argued over whether the rules should move forward.
I've been trying to get these regs passed.
Representative Vitale,
you're
out of order.
Well, you're referring to me. You're out of order, too.
The two GOP-led committees voted to reject the rules. Representative John Maher is the majority chair of the House panel. He criticized both the substance of the rulemaking and the process DEP had followed.
These are not mere technicalities. I will remind you that it was a Republican initiative that set forth to review and update regulation of the gas patch.
But it didn't end there. The saga continued as the regulations then went before the state's Independent Regulatory Review Commission,
calling to order the meeting,
which held a seven-hour-long meeting last spring and heard from people like Joe Thompson of Devonian Resources, who argued the regulations would cripple business.
The spirit of the law has been ignored, and our already reeling industry stands to suffer a death blow.
Despite similar pleas, the commission approved the rules, and it looked like a win for state regulators. There was a lot of internal high-fiving at DEP. But then came another twist.
Well, a few storm clouds have been circling the state capitol. Environmental Protection Secretary John Quigley resigned last week after firing off an offensive email that caused outrage.
In the email, Quigley sharply criticized environmental groups for failing to push back against legislative attacks on the regulations.
The email is as salty as fracking fluid. Quigley writes, "Where the F-word expletive were you people yesterday?"
When word of the note surfaced, Quigley was out of a job. Not long after that, Governor Tom Wolf's administration announced a deal with the Republican-led legislature. It was June, the annual budget crunch time. Half the regulations would be tossed out, those dealing with the conventional oil and gas industry, which drills shallower wells. The Marcellus Shale drilling regulations were allowed to move forward. Representative Greg Vitale, the Democratic chair of the House Environmental Resources and Energy Committee, was not impressed.
I don't think the people remaining in Wolf's top echelon really prioritize the environment.
The intense political battle over the regulations is pretty unprecedented. That's according to Kurt Klepkowski with DEP's oil and gas program. He says it's unlike anything he's seen in his nearly 23-year career at the agency.
It's just the reality that we operate in, and we try to be analytical. We try to be professional. We try to divorce ourselves from those political processes as much as possible.
That might not be very possible. The department is right now trying to fend off the lawsuits and reboot the regulations for the conventional industry that were killed during budget negotiations. It will likely take another 2 years. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
The Archaeology Museum at the University of Pennsylvania is about to launch its first online class for the public. The massive online open course, or MOOC, starting Monday, will be about ancient Egypt. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Kearns reports that over 20,000 people have already signed up.
David Silverman is one of the world's foremost authorities on ancient Egypt, so whenever a crackpot theory about Egypt comes to the surface, like, for example, space aliens must have built the pyramids, he is asked to comment. He doesn't mind, because even wackadoo questions lead to interesting answers.
When you go into the pyramids above the burial chamber, you can actually see writing of some of the workers on the walls above this burial chamber, indicating they were there, they were working on it.
Silverman is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania and the curator of the Egyptian section of the museum. He will teach a 10-session online class available to anyone for free, touching on Egyptian gods and goddesses, pyramids and sphinxes, mummies, hieroglyphics. With almost 22,000 people on the roll, there will be little direct interaction between teacher and student. Instead, there will be video lectures, detailed images and information of the museum's collection of 50,000 artifacts, a blog for questions and answers, and yes, a test. Back in the 1970s, Silverman was part of the team that created the massively popular museum exhibition on King Tut, which toured the world. He says this massive online open course will serve a similar purpose, to feed the seemingly bottomless interest the public has for ancient Egypt.
Even in the world of horror movies, The Mummy probably still stands as one of the most interesting to people. I'm not quite sure why, but maybe because a lot of people have their first exposure to Egypt in studies about the Bible. So they're familiar with it.
Although 22,000 people signed up for this course, more than half are expected to drop out before it ends. For those that stick it out, there will be a live in-person event at the museum where students can finally meet their professor in real life. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.